Chapter 2. Jill is given a task. Without a glance at Jill, the lion rose to its feet and gave one last blow. Then, as if satisfied with its work, it turned and stalked slowly away back into the forest. "Must be a dream. It must, said Jill to herself. I'll wake up in a moment. But it wasn't, and she didn't. I do wish we'd never come to this dreadful place, said Jill. I don't believe Scrub knew any more about it than I do. Or if he did, he had no business to bring me here without warning me what it was like. It's not my fault he fell over that cliff. If he'd left me alone, we should both be all right. Then she remembered again the scream that Scrub had given when he fell and burst into tears. Crying is all right in its way while it lasts, but you have to stop sooner or later, and then you still have to decide what to do. When Jill stopped, she found she was dreadfully thirsty. She'd been lying face downward, and now she sat up. The birds had ceased singing, and there was perfect silence, except for one small, persistent sound, which seemed to come from a good distance away. She listened carefully, and felt almost sure it was the sound of running water. Jill got up and looked round her very carefully. There was no sign of the lion, but there were so many trees about that it might easily be quite close without her seeing it. For all she knew, there might be several lions. But her thirst was very bad now, and she plucked up her courage to go and look for that running water. She went on tiptoes, stealing cautiously from tree to tree, and stopping to peer round her at every step. The wood was so still that it was not difficult to decide where the sound was coming from. It grew clearer every moment, and sooner than she expected, she came to an open glade and saw the stream, bright as glass, running across the turf, a stone's throw away from her. But although the sight of the water made her feel 10 times thirstier than before, she didn't rush forward and drink. She stood as still as if she'd been turned into stone, with her mouth wide open. And she had a very good reason. Just on this side of the stream lay the lion. It lay with its head raised and its 2 forepaws out in front of it, like the lions in Trafalgar Square. She knew at once that it had seen her, for its eyes looked straight into hers for a moment and then turned away, as if it knew her quite well and didn't think much of her. "If I run away, it'll be after me in a moment," thought Jill, "and if I go on, I shall run straight into its mouth." Anyway, she couldn't have moved if she had tried. She couldn't take her eyes off it. How long this lasted, she could not be sure. It seemed like hours. And the thirst became so bad that she almost felt she would not mind being eaten by the lion if only she could be sure of getting a mouthful of water first. "If you're thirsty, you may drink." They were the first words she had heard since Scrub had spoken to her on the edge of the cliff. For a second she stared here and there, wondering who had spoken. Then the voice said again, "If you are thirsty, come and drink." And of course she remembered what Scrub had said about animals talking in that other world, and realized that it was the lion speaking. Anyway, she'd seen its lips move this time, and the voice was not like a man's. It was deeper, wilder, and stronger, a sort of heavy, golden voice. It did not make her any less frightened than she'd been before, but it made her frightened in rather a different way. "Are you not thirsty?" said the lion. "I'm dying of thirst," said Jill. "Then drink," said the lion. Would you mind going away while I do?" said Jill. The lion answered this only by a look and a very low growl. And as Jill gazed at its motionless bulk, she realized that she might as well have asked the whole mountain to move aside for her convenience. The delicious rippling noise of the stream was driving her nearly frantic. "Would you promise not to do anything to me if I do come?" said Jill. "I make no promise," said the lion. Jill was so thirsty now that, without noticing it, she had come a step nearer. "Do you eat, girls?" she said. I have swallowed up girls and boys, women and men, kings and emperors, cities and realms, said the lion. It didn't say this as if it were boasting, nor as if it were sorry, nor as if it were angry. It just said it. I daren't come and drink, said Jill. Then you will die of thirst, said the lion. Oh dear, said Jill, coming another step nearer. I suppose I must go and look for another stream, then. There is no other stream, said the lion. It never occurred to Jill to disbelieve the lion. No one who had seen his stern face could do that. And her mind suddenly made itself up. It was the worst thing that she had ever had to do. But she went forward to the stream, knelt down, and began scooping up water in her hand. It was the coldest, most refreshing water she had ever tasted. You didn't need to drink much of it, for it quenched your thirst at once. Before she tasted it, she'd been intending to make a dash away from the lion the moment she had finished. Now, she realized that this would be, on the whole, the most dangerous thing of all. She got up and stood there with her lips still wet from drinking. Come here, said the lion. And she had to. She was almost between its front paws now, looking straight into its face. But she couldn't stand that for long. She dropped her eyes. Human child, said the lion. Where is the boy? He fell over the cliff, said Jill, and added, Sir. She didn't know what else to call him, and it sounded cheek to call him nothing. How did he come to do that, human child?
He was trying to stop me from falling, sir.
Why were you so near the edge, human child?
I was showing off, sir.
That is a very good answer, human child. Do so no more. And now, here for the first time the lion's face became a little less stern, the boy is safe. I have blown him to Narnia. But your task will be the harder because of what you have done.
Please, what task, sir? Said Jill.
The task for which I called you and him here out of your own world. This puzzled Jill very much. It's mistaking me for someone else, she thought. She didn't dare to tell the lion this, though she felt things would get into a dreadful muddle unless she did. Speak your thought, human child, said the lion.
I was wondering, I mean, could there be some mistake? Because nobody called me and Scrub, you know. It was we who asked to come here. Scrub said we were to call to somebody. It was a name I wouldn't know, and perhaps the somebody would let us in. And we did, and then we found the door open.
You would not have called to me unless I had been calling to you, said the lion.
Then you are somebody, sir? Said Jill.
I am. And now hear your task. Far from here in the land of Narnia there lives an aged king who is sad because he has no prince of his blood to be king after him. He has no heir because his only son was stolen from him many years ago, and no one in Narnia knows where that prince went or whether he is still alive. But he is. I lay on you this command, that you seek this lost prince until either you have found him and brought him to his father's house, or else died in the attempt, or else gone back into your own world.
How, please, said Jill.
I will tell you, child, said the lion. These are the signs by which I will guide you in your quest. First, as soon as the boy Eustace sets foot in Narnia, he will meet an old and dear friend. He must greet that friend at once. If he does, you will both have good help. Second, you must journey out of Narnia to the north till you come to the ruined city of the ancient giants. Third, you shall find a writing on a stone in that ruined city, and you must do what the writing tells you. Fourth, you will know the lost prince, if you find him, by this, that he will be the first person you have met in your travels who will ask you to do something in my name. in the name of Aslan." As the lion seemed to have finished, Jill thought she should say something, so she said, "Thank you very much, I see."
"Child," said Aslan, in a gentler voice than he had yet used, "perhaps you do not see quite as well as you think, but the first step is to remember. Repeat to me, in order, the four signs." Jill tried, and didn't get them quite right, so the lion corrected her and made her repeat them again and again, till she could say them perfectly. He was very patient over this, so that when it was done, Jill plucked up courage to ask, "Please, how am I to get to Narnia?"
"On my breath," said the lion, "I will blow you into the west of the world as I blew Eustace."
"Shall I catch him in time to tell him the first sign? Oh, but I suppose it won't matter. If he sees an old friend, he's sure to go and speak to him, isn't he?"
"You will have no time to spare," said the lion. "That is why I must send you at once. Come, walk before me to the edge of the cliff."
Jill remembered very well that if there was no time to spare, that was her own fault. If I hadn't made such a fool of myself, Scrub and I would have been going together, and he'd have heard all the instructions as well as me, she thought. So she did as she was told. It was very alarming walking back to the edge of the cliff, especially as the lion did not walk with her but behind her, making no noise on his soft paws. But long before she'd got anywhere near the edge, the voice behind her said,
"Stand still. In a moment I will blow, but first remember, remember, remember the signs. Say them to yourself when you wake in the morning, and when you lie down at night, and when you wake in the middle of the night. And whatever strange things may happen to you, let nothing turn your mind from following the signs. And secondly, I give you a warning. Here on the mountain I have spoken to you clearly. I will not often do so down in Narnia. Here on the mountain the air is clear and your mind is clear. As you drop down into Narnia, the air will thicken. Take great care that it does not confuse your mind. And the signs which you have learned here will not look at all as you expect them to look when you meet them there. That is why it is so important to know them by heart and pay no attention to appearances. Remember the signs and believe the signs. Nothing else matters. And now, daughter of Eve, farewell."
The voice had been growing softer towards the end of this speech, and now it faded away altogether. Jill looked behind her. To her astonishment, she saw the cliff already more than 100 yards behind her, and the lion himself a speck of bright gold on the edge of it. She'd been setting her teeth and clenching her fists for a terrible blast of lion's breath, but the breath had really been so gentle that she had not even noticed the moment at which she left the earth. And now there was nothing but air for thousands upon thousands of feet below her. She felt frightened only for a second. For one thing, the world beneath her was so very far away that it seemed to have nothing to do with her. For another, floating on the breath of the lion was so extremely comfortable. She found she could lie on her back or on her face and twist any way she pleased, just as you can in water if you learn to float really well. And because she was moving at the same pace as the breath, there was no wind, and the air seemed beautifully warm. It was not in the least like being in an aeroplane, because there was no noise and no vibration. If Jill had ever been in a balloon, she might have thought it more like that, only better. When she looked back now, she could take in for the first time the real size of the mountain she was leaving. She wondered why a mountain so huge as that was not covered with snow and ice, but I suppose all that sort of thing is different in this world, thought Jill. Then she looked below her. But she was so high that she couldn't make out whether she was floating over land or sea, nor what speed she was going at. "By Jove, the signs," said Jill suddenly. "I'd better repeat them." She was in a panic for a second or two, but she found she could still say them all correctly. So that's all right, she said, and lay back on the air as if it was a sofa with a sigh of contentment. Well, I do declare, said Jill to herself some hours later, I've been asleep. Fancy sleeping on air. I wonder if anyone's done it before. I don't suppose they have. Oh, bother, Scrub probably has. On this same journey a little bit before me. Let's see what it looks like down below. What it looked like was an enormous, very dark blue plain. There were no hills to be seen, but there were biggish white things moving slowly across it. Those must be clouds, she thought, but far bigger than the ones we saw from the cliff. I suppose they're bigger because they're nearer. I must be getting lower. Bother this sun. The sun, which had been high overhead when she began her journey, was now getting in her eyes, and this meant that it was getting lower, ahead of her. Scrub was quite right in saying that Jill, I don't know about girls in general, didn't think much about points of the compass. Otherwise she would have known, when the sun began getting in her eyes, that she was travelling pretty nearly due west. Staring at the blue plain below her, she presently noticed that there were little dots of brighter, paler colour in it here and there. It's the sea, thought Jill. I do believe those are islands. And so they were. She might have felt rather jealous if she had known that some of them were islands which Scrub had seen from a ship's deck, and even landed on. But she didn't know this. Then, later on, she began to see that there were little wrinkles on the blue flatness, little wrinkles which must be quite big ocean waves if you were down among them. And now, all along the horizon, there was a thick, dark line which grew thicker and darker so quickly that you could see it growing. That was the first sign that she had had of the great speed at which she was travelling, and she knew that the thickening line must be land. Suddenly from her left, for the wind was in the south, a great white cloud came rushing towards her, this time on the same level as herself. And before she knew where she was, she had shot right into the middle of its cold, wet fogginess. That took her breath away, but she was in it only for a moment. She came out, blinking in the sunlight, and found her clothes wet. She had on a blazer and sweater, and shorts and stockings and pretty thick shoes. It had been a muddy sort of day in England. She came out lower than she'd gone in, and as soon as she did so, she noticed something which I suppose she ought to have been expecting, but which came as a surprise and a shock. It was noises. Up till then she had travelled in total silence. Now, for the first time, she heard the noise of waves and the crying of seagulls, and now, too, she smelled the smell of the sea. There's no mistake about her speed now. She saw two waves meet with a smack and a spout of foam go up between them. But she had hardly seen it before it was 100 yards behind her. The land was getting nearer at a great pace. She could see mountains far inland, and other nearer mountains on her left. She could see bays and headlands, woods and fields, stretches of sandy beach. The sound of waves breaking on the shore was growing louder every second and drowning the other sea noises. Suddenly, the land opened right ahead of her. She was coming to the mouth of a river. She was very low now, only a few feet above the water. A wave top came against her toe, and a great splash of foam spurted up, drenching her nearly to the waist. Now she was losing speed. Instead of being carried up the river, she was gliding into the river bank on her left. There were so many things to notice that she could hardly take them all in. A smooth green lawn, a ship so brightly coloured that it looked like an enormous piece of jewellery, towers and battlements, banners fluttering in the air, a crowd, gay clothes, armour, gold, swords, a sound of music, but this was all jumbled. The first thing that she knew clearly was that she had alighted and was standing under a thicket of trees close by the riverside, and there, only a few feet away from her, was Scrub. The first thing she thought was how very grubby and untidy and generally unimpressive he looked. And the second was, how wet I am.